Hey everyone, it's Norm Farrar, aka the Beard Guy here, and welcome to another Lunch with Norm, the Rise of the Micro Brands. Lunch with Norm. Lunch with Norm. All right, today our guest is co-owner of Quiet Light Brokerage, Joe Valley, and he's one of the first people I met in the Amazon space, which is kind of cool. He's going to be talking about how to sell your business, some tips and tricks about, or not tricks, but just tips about selling your business, if it's an Amazon business, what to look for. So I'm really looking forward to it. Every time I talk to Joe, I've been on his podcast before. He's just an awesome guy. But before we get to Joe, just wanted to let you know that we are broadcasting to you live on Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And if you're watching this on a replay, skip it. You can forget all about this stuff. You can just skip ahead and get to the meat. Anyways, for those of you on my personal Facebook page, you can always head over to the official Norm Farrar, aka the Beard Guy page, where you can get highlights, more content, and whole episodes. Now, where is my son? And Kelsey is so quiet today.
Oh, all right. There we go.
There he is.
All right. You can see me. I might have to refresh my page on this side.
I can see you perfectly, sir.
Okay. Perfect. All right. So yes, if you're watching us, please follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok. So you can find us all. You can either search Lunch with Norm or Norm Farrar and we should pop up. Yeah, go ahead and like and share. And we have a brand new Facebook group too. So I'm going to put that in the links in the comment section, but feel free to join us there. You just have to answer 3 questions. And it looks like we have a couple guests already joining us. We have Victor, Nathan.
All right. Hey, Victor.
Simon. We got Dr. Cos back. All right. So awesome.
All right. Yeah.
You guys so enjoy the show.
Welcome back, everybody. Nathan, Simon, Dr. Cos. And
Victor
and Giz.
Yeah, that's Victor.
That's Victor?
Yep.
How'd you know that?
He's told us before.
All right. Okay, so let me see. Kelsey, I just wanted to let you know that your mic is lagging a little bit. I don't know if it's Wi-Fi or what it is, but at least it seems like it's coming through a little bit slow.
Yeah, I think I might have to refresh the page, but if you lose me, I'll be back in a second.
Very good. So if we lose Kels, sorry, Kels, you're off the podcast. All right. So if you have any questions, throw them over into the comment area and we will get to them throughout the podcast. We love engagement. So just let us know, you know, if you do have any questions. I'm blind as a bat, so Kelsey will have to read them out or I'll just make them up. Anyways, sit back, relax, grab a cup of coffee, and enjoy the show. Mr. Valley.
I knew that was going to happen. The moment we go live, my wife walks in over there in the dogs bark. Hi, everybody. These are my dogs. Goodness gracious. It was like literally to the second. I'm thinking, I see her out front with Dana. She's going to, okay, there they go. Sorry about that.
Is the other dog called White?
Wife?
No,
White. Dog?
Dana, no. White?
No. Dasher. That's Dasher right there.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
like a little reindeer. No. No, the woman is called Dana, not the dog.
Oh, I am so sorry. Yeah. I thought you were talking about Kush, Kush, Kush.
Yeah,
oh my God.
You're in trouble.
I'm sorry, Dana.
Happy belated birthday, by the way.
Pardon me?
Happy belated birthday, by the way.
Well, thank you, sir. I got to tell you, you're one of the nicest guys I know. We had the pleasure of meeting, I think the first time was down in Cancun at the Illuminati Mastermind.
Yep.
With Manny Coates and Kevin King and Guy. And we had a chance to talk a little bit. I think Elena Ceres was the one that connected us, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So it's been years.
Lots changed.
Can you imagine, like, how much has changed in Amazon since we first met?
I remember I went to an event in 2016, Norm. I think we met in 15. I think. I can't remember when we went to Cancun. I went to an event in 2016, and it's an annual event for this large e-commerce group, and we were sponsoring it, and I was so proud of myself. I wrote a little book called 10 Steps to Selling Your Amazon Business, and I was just, you know, it was printed, it was up on the desk, and anybody could take it if they wanted to, and the host of the event gets up and quickly goes through the stats of their 1,000 people. And like only 20% of them were even selling on Amazon. So he was boasting how proud they all were to not be Amazon people. And my ego went like through the floor because I was so proud of that book. And then none of them were selling. Fast forward to the last time I went to that event, they're all on Amazon. It's like, it's completely flipped. You know, 20% of them are doing, you know, most of their brand on their own websites, but most of it's through third-party platforms like Amazon these days.
You know, it's hard to avoid. It's funny that you just said that, you know, everybody's selling on Amazon. And like today I had an email that came through and somebody was asking me a couple of questions and they were talking about listing their, you know, putting their products on, putting their brand on, they sell retail. And then in the email, he says, I went to Fiverr and I got them to, you know, put a listing up for me. And I'm sitting there going, your brand, you're a retail brand, like you're an established brand. Why are you going to Fiverr? Why?
You know, they don't know any better.
If they only knew that, you know, pay the buck, if you can't do it, or if you don't want to do it yourself, pay the buck for an expert. Now there could be probably some good Fiverr people out there. It's like going onto Fiverr and saying, hey, I'm going to find a broker to sell my business. For $5.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll do it. I'm sure you save that broker fee, but you're not going to get the value for your business. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And that's the same with the listing. So, hey, Joe, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Obviously, as was mentioned, I'm a partner at Quiet Light Brokerage. I sold my own e-commerce business, or my last e-commerce business, I should say, in November of 2010. And then I joined the Quiet Light team in 2012. I think in my entrepreneurial life, which I've been self-employed since 1997, I've bought two companies, invested in three, and sold two. And my only asset now in terms of entrepreneurial ventures is Quiet Light Brokerage. It's all I do at this point. But I've sold my own online businesses. And I joined the team in 2012. At the time, it was just myself and Mark, Jason, and Amanda. And we've grown up since then. I think our average transaction value was somewhere around $150,000, $200,000. And our largest transaction may have been $500,000 or $600,000. Now our largest transaction before the end of this year will be close to $25 million. Our average transaction size probably in the $1.3, $1.4 million. Before the end of this year, some of those larger ones are pulling it up. It's surprising for us, Norm. It's as an entrepreneur, which we all are, and I want people to look at us that way. We all struggle with promoting ourselves to our own level of incompetence, if you will, right? You know, are you an expert at Facebook, or do you have to be? Are you going to figure it out yourself, or you know, rankings? Are you going to hire somebody from Fiverr to do your photographs or something like that? And we keep getting pulled in the direction of the larger transactions, even though we often fight it. And we're still trying to figure out if we want to continue to go in that area, in that direction. I just had a call with somebody this morning. And as we're talking, I'm going to pull up something on my other screen just so I can talk specifics. But I had a call with somebody this morning that, you know, his business is doing probably about $3 million in discretionary earnings this year. And, you know, he's doing a lot of pre-planning and wants to have a $100 million exit. And that's, you know, it's not what we do right now. Right. But a few years ago, I would have said, yeah, we're not doing anything more than 10 million. And then we did one for 10. Okay. No more than 15. Okay. We did one for 15, no more than 20. Now we're going to close one for 25. So in 3 or 4 years, we might be in a position where we're, you know, in the middle of $100 million transactions. I don't know for sure. But I don't want that kind of stat to turn people away from who we are and what we do. Because first and foremost, we're entrepreneurs. Everybody on the team has built, bought, or sold their own online business. The latest person that we just brought on, a guy named Pat Yates. He owns a company called Happy Feet. He cut a deal with Robert on Shark Tank back in 2014. Brad's rolled up 30 content sites, sold to private equity firm. Amanda was on the cover of a Time magazine for her importing business for pearls back in the day. But our largest listing, if it closes, will be $25 million this year. But strangely enough, our smallest will be $16,389. So we're kind of all over. I don't want to scare too many people away. Usually those smaller ones are our pocket listings, where it's somebody that has a larger business, you know, that's half a million, 2 million, 5 million, not sure. But they also have this other smaller business, and they want to sell that separately. And we just, we don't list those. We just find them a buyer from the buyer pool that we have. That wasn't really about myself, was it? I'm not sure if I answered that question or not.
Well, I know you, and you don't like, you know, just talking about yourself. You don't have these 12 page bios that some people do. So and that's what I like about you. Oh, you know what's funny is when we first met, you probably don't remember, but it was, I just remember this. It was the Prosper Show. I went up and asked you a couple of questions. And then we met at Cancun. But Mark Doust, just kind of just to throw it in there, has the same last name as my mother. But in Canada, it's called Dau.
No kidding.
Yeah. So Mark, like when I saw Mark's name out there, I said, nobody, I mean, this is the first person I've ever seen with that last name. And I went up to him and I asked him about that. And I said, yeah, how do you pronounce it? And he goes, Doust. And I said, oh, well, in Canada, it's Dau.
Yeah. I would imagine if you pop that name in a LinkedIn profile and into LinkedIn, there's not going to be that many names that come up.
I don't think so. Well, let's move on to some e-commerce now. So you sold an e-commerce business. What's the difference between an e-com business, online sales, Shopify, selling that and selling an Amazon business? Or is there a difference?
In terms of the process and transaction, there's not a ton of difference, really. The value is probably higher on an e-commerce business than, let's just call it strictly FBA business, even though you might be doing the fulfillment yourself. Because there's less risk in the FBA, I'm sorry, in the e-commerce business. When you've got multiple channels of revenue, there's less risk. Lower risk increases a higher value, and you as the owner of that business will get a higher value for the business. Now, with that said, the Amazon space is maturing and more buyers are stepping into the space. They're getting much more comfortable, right? Back in 2016 with my proud, literally, it was probably 30 pages, Norm, 10 steps to selling your Amazon business. I laugh at it now, but you know, no one was comfortable with it. They all thought they had the Chicken Little attitude where the sky is falling with Amazon. It's too much risk and all this other stuff. It's totally changed. Amazon is fully committed to the third-party sellers. It's a huge part of their profit and what they focus on. They're running ads on it now on TV. It's primarily around Prime Day, but it's coming up in value. It's probably still not going to equate to a business that's doing 50% of its revenue on Shopify and 50% on Amazon. If we had two identical revenue and profit-based businesses, and one was 95% Amazon, which is an Amazon business, and the other was 50-50. The other one, let's just call it for round numbers, let's say that the, we'll go 100,000, right? Small numbers, 100,000 in profit or discretionary earnings, as it's called, the Amazon business might be at 3x plus or minus. It's 3x that discretionary earnings times three, or be a 300,000. Then it's plus inventory separate. The e-commerce business, the balanced one, would more than likely be 20 to 30% higher in total value, maybe even more. So it would be at, you know, 3.4x. So you're going to earn money with a diversified business than you are with a strictly Amazon business. But the buyer pool is strong in either. And a lot of holding companies have started to form to buy FBA businesses and roll them up. That's a plus, but it's also a minus because they pay terribly. They're looking for businesses at an incredibly low multiple. The upside for those FBA business owners, if you're in a high risk niche on FBA and you've got a hero SKU, meaning you're doing 70% of your revenue, the holding company will buy those because they don't mind buying something with one or two hero SKUs versus your average buyer is going to look for something that's more balanced because they're a little bit more risk averse.
Right. So one of the things I'm wondering about, I get asked this all the time, is it still a problem to transfer your business on Amazon?
No. Why the hell does anybody think that's a problem?
I know.
Jesus Christ, people. Look, Thrasio's doing it. They just got a $1 billion valuation. Do you think they're raising huge venture cap money and they can't transfer control of a seller account? Right? Go literally 10. I said it so many times, 10 steps to selling my Amazon business. I had an Amazon business. I got written permission from Amazon to transfer my account. I just asked them how to do it enough times. So they finally just said, here's how you do it. And they put it in writing. They sent me an email. It's in the book. No, it's perfectly fine to transfer control of a seller account. In the US, a US to US one is not hard at all. It gets hard when you're a US business owner and trying to transfer a German or UK account or something like that, because their money laundering laws are much more stringent than ours. And it's the government that's making it harder, not Amazon. But in the US, if you're buying a US Amazon account, it's not hard at all. Norm, I tell you what, why don't we pull up your screen and you transfer control of one of your Amazon accounts over to me right now. And so we can show people. I'll just put in my banking information. I'll pay you $1. How's that? I buy your business for $1. You give me full control. We'll do it live right now.
Sure. Let's do that. I'll give you sure.
It could be done that quickly is my point. Literally, yeah. We've been talking for 17 minutes now. And in the next 10, I could take control of your Amazon account. It's not hard.
But you do have to just notify Amazon, right? Both parties have to notify Amazon that this is going to take place.
Have to is advised. Suggested is advised. But lots of people do it without. We definitely recommend that our business owners reach out to Amazon via the chat, whatever it might be, email, and say, hey, look, I'm selling my business, and one of the assets of my business is my Amazon seller account. How do I change control of that? The first 8 times you ask that question, they're going to say, oh, no, you can't do that, sir. And then the 9th time, they're going to say, oh, yeah, no problem. This is how you do it. Log into the seller account, update the banking information, update the EIN number, and that kind of stuff. It's not hard. The one thing to know is that the humans at Amazon don't communicate with the bots at Amazon. So if we were to log in, if I were to take over control of somebody's Amazon account right now, and they live in Boise, Idaho, and they've been logging in from their local URL, their local IP address in Boise, Idaho, every day for the last 3 years, and they have a personal email address inside their Amazon account that they're going to keep. When I log in and I update the banking information and the EIN number and then the email address, the bots are going to go crazy. Mm-hmm. And they're going to pause the account. They're going to prevent anybody from withdrawing any money from the account. Odds are the account's still going to be live and you'll still be able to process orders and ship to customers. But because you changed all three at the same time, the account may get suspended. Now, keep in mind that we do this, we're involved in these transactions every day. And I think in the last 24 months, there have been maybe 2 that this happened to. So my advice now, do it now, don't wait, is stop using a personal email address in your account. Use an email address that's going to transfer with control of the account. So you're not updating the banking information, the EIN number, and the email address. It's when you update that email address all at the same time, the bots can go a little wacky and pause the account. But it's easy to do. Some transactions where people are super paranoid and maybe have attorneys that are heavily involved with it will update one piece of that every few days. So they'll update the banking information. They'll wait 3 to 5 days. They'll update the banking information. They'll wait 3 to 5 days. They'll update the email address. But you can avoid all of that by updating the email address to one that's going to transfer with control of the Amazon account now versus the day that you sell.
That's a great point. I've had some experience with this where we were changing banks and just everything like you just said. And the account got suspended. It was probably suspended for a week plus. Then because of this, the next time we went to do this, we notified Amazon and just told them what we were doing, that we were changing the bank account, changing this, changing that. And it was suspended again, but we were suspended for an hour rather than for a week. So like what we're doing now is anytime there's any changes to the account, we change the, we just call Amazon and open up a case and try to talk to them directly about it, but you could just open up a case.
Yeah. So many people are afraid of Amazon, that it's Big Brother, that you try to make any changes that appear as though they're against terms of services, your account's going to be shut down. That's not what they're about. They're about, you know, profit and making money, servicing, you know, the Amazon customer, and they want to help you, you know, succeed. They're not here to shut you down. Now, look, everybody's heard stories, horror stories of accounts being shut down for no reason. Behind the Amazon headquarters are humans, and humans do make mistakes. And I've heard plenty of situations where they've screwed up. I was talking to somebody maybe a month ago that sells pesticides or something along those lines. And if at a glance, it looks like it's something that is not allowed to be sold yet. When you look at the full ingredients, it is. Well, they shut down his account. They actually destroyed product. But Amazon was wrong, and he hired somebody to help him, and Amazon reimbursed him 100% for all of the product at the full list price, not at cost of goods sold, at the full cost, as if he would have sold it all. So, you know, I think the fact that you open up a case and speak to somebody there is the right thing to do. Just, they're human. They want to help.
You know, one of the strangely other things, when you're, and I'm interested in your opinion. A lot of these companies create multiple brands. They put them under the same company. Mm. What's your opinion? Should you have a separate company per brand?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's called commingling. And the problem with commingling is that, you know, if you've got five brands under one umbrella and they're all using the same staff, they're all using the same bank account, the same bookkeeper, and you want to sell one of the brands, you're going to be limited in terms of your buyers because you cannot pull off a completely separate and accurate profit and loss statement. So your buyers are going to have to be very comfortable with looking at, you know, the Amazon reports and ballparking the bottom line discretionary earnings. One of the key things that buyers want, sometimes we call them pillars, but it's what buyers want, is documentation. They want clean and accurate documentation. And that primarily is focused on books, your financial records. And so the best situation is when you have one bank account, one EIN number for that one brand, and you can run a separate profit and loss statement for them. Now, what happens if you have multiple brands and a bunch of VAs that work on those different brands? You just have to allocate their time towards each brand, and there's software out there to do that. It's more work, but you get paid for it at the end of the day. You're going to get a higher value for your business when you eventually exit if you've got clean books and clean financials and separate payroll and all those different things than if it's all commingled. In addition, you know, you're going to be able to open up the buyer pool to SBA buyers. So if you're a US-based company with US tax returns and you commingle everything and you just want to sell off one of the brands, you're not getting SBA pre-approved. If you have everything separate, you are going to get SBA pre-approved, most likely, if the cash flow works in terms of the list price of the business. By way of example, I launched one on Friday. I hate launching on Fridays because I don't like working Friday afternoons, but we launched one every day last week. So selfishly, I didn't want to launch one on Friday. Just it was SBA eligible, 1,050,000. Email blew up. We've had 7 calls booked already with qualified buyers because it's SBA pre-qualified. It doesn't mean that it'll be an SBA buyer, but it will certainly get the cash buyers off the fence quicker because there's more competition. So I think it's absolutely in your best interest as a business owner to keep separate books and don't commingle. it's a challenge sometimes, I understand, and it seems like work, but you have to accept or take my word, if you will, because I don't know who you are right now. It's worth it because I've sold 100 million in transactions of these, and each and every single time, those that have clean financials get a much higher value. You commingle and you're not going to get the same value, and it's going to hurt you along the way.
And along those lines, when you're talking about selling your business, you're talking, for the most part, selling the assets of the business.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just want to make that clear. You know, anybody that's new to Amazon or what, trying to sell a business, is that you're not actually buying the entire business, you're buying the assets of the business. So you can limit risk.
Yep. Hey, Norm, we've got a whole bunch of comments as well on the right. Do you want me to, as we go through?
So this is Kelsey's job. This is what I pay.
I know, but you said, oh, he's back. It's working.
Yeah, I'm back. Yeah.
Let me just touch on the asset sale versus the stock sale, Kelsey. These are asset sales, which means you keep the empty shell of your business and all of your assets of the business move over to me. I take control of it, or your buyer, of course. So it's the brand, it's your relationships, it's your email, all those different things, if it's a business email address. But you keep the money in the bank, any accounts payable, any accounts receivable are yours. Any revenue from the day of closing forward is mine. Any revenue from the day before closing is yours. The risk associated with those transactions are yours. And you end up with an empty shell. It's a cleaner, safer transaction. The stock sale means that I would take on all of your liability. And it means that we'd have to figure out accounts payable, accounts receivable. There's money in your bank account. We don't want you to drain it. We want working capital. And most buyers at this level are looking for asset sales. And when I say this level, call it sub 10 million. They're looking for asset sales, not stock sales. Okay. All right. Go ahead, Kelsey.
Okay, so first off, we have Victor. Now that it's become visible that a high percentage of page one listings in my categories are from China-based sellers, do you think that will impact sale prospects and valuations for US-based sellers?
I haven't seen it yet, right? Everybody talks about, before it was Amazon shutting them down, now it's Chinese competitors. And I haven't seen, and I don't see as much as Norm, so you can speak to this, in terms of the high quality Amazon sellers competing against high quality US Amazon sellers. I've seen a situation recently where somebody was selling neck gaiters at $40 a pop. It was really a company that sold rash guards, and they were doing incredibly well. It's a company that's 10 years old, and then their revenue blew up because of the neck gaiters. Odd timing, right, with the pandemic. But those Chinese sellers came in and drove the price down. So his COVID bump are gone in that situation. But we haven't seen a ton of direct evidence that's going to hurt the sale value in terms of, well, you've got Chinese competitors, so therefore we're going to put you at a lower multiple. The way it's going to be automatically translated is if your Chinese competitors are hurting your revenue and your profits, it's going to show up in the profit loss statement. And that's where we're going to interpret it, that your revenue is trending down, or your revenue is flat, but your profit is down. And we're going to ask the question, why? Then you're going to address the Chinese competition. And it's going to hurt your value if that's the case. But that would be the case even if it wasn't Chinese competitors. If it was any competitors, or you're just taking your eye off the ball and revenue dropping, your value for your business is going to get lower because of the risk associated with a decreasing multiple or decreasing profits.
Okay, great. All right, our next one is from Simon. Does the interest change either positively or negatively if the business also has wholesale customers?
Yes, it changes to the positive in the sense that if it's a wholesale customer, really assuming that you own the brand and you have wholesale buyers, they're buying in larger quantities and they're repeat buyers. So they're buying on a monthly or quarterly or semi-annual basis at a larger clip. And that's recurring revenue, and recurring revenue decreases risk, right? And increases the overall value of the business. You have to take that with a grain of salt, because if you have one wholesale customer that's representing 60% of your total revenue, that's too much risk, because it's one customer and it's 60% of revenue. And that's actually going to decrease the overall value of your business in terms of the multiple because of the risk associated with that one customer.
Okay, perfect. From Yaro, he's asking, when does the multiplier start growing from 3 to 4 and more? Yeah. How big should be your revenue profit to have a better multiplier?
Right. It's a good question. It's one we get often. Revenue-wise, ignore it completely because your business is not going to be valued on revenue. It's going to be valued on profit or what's called seller's discretionary earnings. So that's net income plus ad backs. What the hell's an ad back? It's your owner salary. It's your mastermind groups. It's your credit card cash back that you slide over to your personal account and don't report it. There's no way to properly report it anyway. The IRS doesn't know what to do with it, but most people think they're tricking the IRS when in fact it's a discount on advertising. So it's your money anyway. You got to pull that over. Those things can add up to a tremendous amount. So it's net income plus ad backs equals seller's discretionary earnings. Forget about revenue. It's not going to be a multiplier revenue for the most part. If you're doing 35 million in revenue and 40% of it's recurring because you sell dog food, then you're going to get a multiple of total revenue. But if that's not you, then odds are it's not. It's a multiple of discretionary earnings. Now, where does it climb different? You know, how do you determine when you're going to be at 4 times versus 3 times? It's really, really hard. It all depends upon the diversification of that revenue, the documentation around it, how clean your books are and things are of that nature, how old the business is. Do you have IP behind it? Do you have utility or design patent, things of that nature. But ballpark wise, let's just say that you're sub 250,000 in discretionary earnings. Just call that at 2 to 3 times, 2 times to 3 time multiple. You'd be in trouble if you're at 2 times these days, but call it 2 to 3, 2.5 to 3 times. If you're 250 to 500 in discretionary earnings, you might be at that 3 to 3.5 times. And then as the closer you creep to a million, the higher the multiple is going to go. You might be at that 3.5 to even 4.5 times discretionary earnings. Now with us, with everybody that is in this industry and in this niche, with the exception of website closers, we all list them as a multiple of discretionary earnings plus the landed cost of goods sellable inventory on hand at the time of closing. Website closers, they'll lump that inventory into the purchase price. And it has different effects on it, but they're the only ones that do it. So their multiples at a glance will appear higher, but the reality is that it's when you adjust out the inventory, it's all ballpark about the same.
Hey, Joe, you know, we've talked about this before. I love SOPs. I love systems, but having great SOPs and having these great systems in place, it really just makes it a turnkey operation, a nicer operation. It doesn't add to the multiple, does it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Absolutely. Look, we talk about the four pillars here at QuietLine, right? It's age, risk, growth, and documentation. So imagine these are all pillars, stones sitting on top of each other. You know, you got four pillars. They don't do any good at all in, I don't know, let's call it bad. A hurricane's not going to knock them over if we're thinking about Greek pillars. But there's mortar in between them all. And you, Norm, or the owner of the business that's creating those SOPs is the mortar that holds these all together. So these pillars can be called the four things that buyers want. But the fifth thing that they want is to buy a business from somebody that they trust. And somebody that's setting up SOPs and running a business really, really professionally and running it with the next owner in mind. Their goal is not to sell the business for maximum value alone. Their goal is to build a great business so that a great buyer takes it over at a great price someday. And that's when they're going to get maximum value. And that's where the SOPs come in place. So you build SOPs, it's going to do two things. It's going to instill confidence in the potential buyers of your business, but it's also going to make your life easier after you sell the business, because you're not going to have to sit there and train somebody every day on how to do certain tasks, because you can point to the SOPs and say, here it is, give it a shot. I'll run it through with you the first time, but second time, give it a shot on your own. And if you need me, I'm here. But it's going to make it easier for you after the sale as well, because you're going to have to do less work and you're going to get more value because you're instilling confidence in buyers. And they want to buy from people that they trust because they're risking their money. and they want to risk less. So if you do great things in regards to SOPs, you're going to instill confidence in people. They're going to pay you more, bottom line. This listing that I just launched on Friday, again, 7 calls set up already. I've already got 1 full price offer in. Haven't submitted it to the owner yet because we haven't had a conference call with the buyer seller conference call, which we always require. But he's done that. He talked about SOPs on the call this morning. He's a likable guy. He's 66 years old. People trust him. He's instilling confidence in them. They're going to pay more for that business because of a variety of reasons, but one of them is him because they trust him. So yes, SOPs are important.
And how long would a person like that have to stick around? Now, it probably is a different, it's different time factor if you have SOPs because of training.
Yeah.
Typically, how long would a company ask the owner to stick around?
Great question. So the average, what we put in the asset purchase agreement, we actually put it in the letter of intent. And I had this in my LOI and APA when I sold my business back in 2010. It hasn't changed. It's the language is literally up to 40 hours over the first 90 days after closing. And that's built into the purchase price. Now, if you've got a inexperienced buyer, they may get nervous and say, my goodness, that's not enough time. I'll tell them it is and that they'll never use it because I rarely see anybody even use that much time. We'll say, okay, well, why don't we do up to 40 hours over the first 90 days after closing? And then for the next 90 days, we'll do up to 5 hours a month for the following 90 days. But you're not working for the buyer of your business. You're helping them run your business. You're teaching them, you're training them. You're not doing the work yourself, and they think they're smarter than you are. So they're gonna kick you to the curb pretty quickly is what I mm-hmm. find. And I do all I can to tell them not to reinvent the wheel, not to fix what's not broken, and just pay attention and don't do anything too dramatically new for a few months. But there's not a ton. Very rarely do I see really nervous buyers need much more handholding. I sold one recently that's a straight up Amazon business, third time somebody's bought from us. It was listed. This is the exception, not the rule, folks. It was listed under contract and closed in about 2.5 weeks. And Rachel, the owner of the business, has not had to help at all because this guy runs 3 other Amazon businesses. It's easy for him.
Okay. Kelsey.
All right. Time for more questions. Okay. Amazon number. When you call Amazon, who do you call? Their main line sucks.
I saw that one. That one's for you, Norm.
No, for this one, all we did was just notify them. We opened up, I believe it was just a case and letting them know. I think that's what it was. We just opened up the case. And we got confirmation back through the case that we could sell the business.
Okay, perfect.
Unless that's any different from you, Joe, if you have a special email or anything, but I think that's what we did.
No, back in the day when I was trying to get them to give me a confirmation in writing that I could transfer my seller account, I just kept hounding them. I just literally, I think I sent 10 or 11 emails and texts and chats and all this until eventually I got somebody in the US that helped me, and I spoke to them and they understood the language I was speaking and gave me what I wanted. So I think you just push and push and push, but no secrets here.
All right. From Victor, how far in advance of a sales should you break out your brands into different companies and SC accounts?
SC being Seller Central, I assume. So the value of your business is going to be based on a number of factors, but the multiply is going to be applied to the trailing 12 months seller's discretionary earnings. So we need at least 12 months. If I want to do a year-over-year comparison of your trailing 12 months seller's discretionary earnings against the previous year, I kind of need another year. Mm-hmm. We could punt and say, all right, well, I'll look at top line revenue for that brand and top line revenue for the previous year, previous months. You could do a year at a minimum. It all depends upon when you want to eventually exit, but I would say without question, a year at a minimum. But the further back you can go, the better. You know, this is, it's where you look at the two men on the screen right now. Both of us gray on our chin. Take some advice and just get this shit done now, right? The longer you wait, you know, you'll hear me say, you hear Norm say, you hear all these other people say these things that you should do, and you know it. You're smart. You're an entrepreneur. You've gotten to where you are. And you say to yourself, I understand. I'll get to it. I'll do that someday. You're going to wake up and go, damn, I'm tired. Someday is here. And you're going to want to exit. And you haven't done it. And then you're going to be emotionally done and want to move on. And the business is not ready to be sold. And you're ready to sell it for less. And it's going to hurt financially. So how do I say this so politely? Sometimes people, we just bootstrap. And I'm guilty. Look, I didn't know how to reconcile QuickBooks when I first started back in 1997. In fact, I was using Quicken, and my brother's best friend was a CPA, and he came out, sat on the back porch with a laptop and a couple of beers, and he reconciled my accounts. And I began to love, you know, the numbers and aspects of it, because I actually had more money than I thought I had with my chicken scratch numbers. The more you mature and get serious about the numbers and preparing the business in a way that you'd want it to be prepared, if you were the buyer risking $100,000, $1 million, whatever it is, the better off you're going to do. These things, accounting and stuff that you're not good at, it may make your eyes bleed, but if you hire somebody to do it for you, or get better at it, it's going to bring more value for you. And I can't express it enough. Just get it done. Get started now. There's great e-commerce bookkeepers that can do it for you. But the simple answer to your question is at least 12 months.
So if Victor has multiple brands right now that are in one company, he wants to get this thing sold. He waits another year, so he breaks it out. Is there any way that you can explain fairly simply that, hey, we've been selling for 4 years, but it was wrapped up in this other company, and we realized that we wanted to get serious about this, so we created a new company with the brand. So there's other data that's back in that old company. Would they take that into consideration, or are they looking at 12 months?
No. They've got to take it into consideration because it goes to the overall trends of the business, right? So if I'm looking at just 12 months, the first thing that they're going to ask is, well, what happened last year? Are you half the size of what you were last year? Because that means your value is less, because you could be going down again. So we've got to look at previous years. We'd want to look at monthly revenue. So in this situation, if all I had were 12 months of separate broken out books, Victor still got access to his seller account, and he knows, in his merchant account, he knows what the total revenue is that was sold for the prior months, for each month in the prior years. I'd say, give me top line revenue numbers. Give me those, and I will take your exported P&L. So you're using QuickBooks or Xero. You export it to Excel with a monthly view, so that every column represents a month. And I would then add the prior month's total revenue. And then I could take your average cost of goods sold and advertising cost, and sort of extrapolate it out going back in time, so that buyers would have some data. I would absolutely note it, make it crystal clear all over the place that those are estimates. Top line revenue is accurate, it's real, but the rest of it is estimates, as is discretionary earnings based upon the trailing 12-month actual numbers. We could do it. It's more detailed, and you got to take your time and do it right in order to instill confidence in the buyers. But yes, it can be done.
So before we go on to any other questions, I've got another one. I had a company come and approach us to buy the company. This goes back years ago, and it wasn't an Amazon company. It was partly an e-com company. But this is one thing that you think, wow, you know, oh, I sold the business. Well, it's not overnight. And what I found out was how much work I had to do to settle this company's due diligence process. Yeah. So I don't know if you have any tips or tricks on what can you do right now if somebody's going to come in and buy your business, how to speed that along, because it was hell. Like they wanted every bloody invoice printed out. They wanted every report we could possibly give. What do we have to do as an Amazon seller to provide that information?
Yep. I remember when I sold my business, I was complaining to my wife. I was working about 20 hours running my e-commerce business. And then when I got to due diligence, I was working full time because I was so unorganized, assume that they're going to want 3 years worth of bank statements, third-party bank statements, 3 years worth of monthly seller account reports that are going to show total revenue and deposits and things of that nature, 3 years worth of manufacturing invoices and statements, all of the common expenses that you have third-party reports to, they're going to look at and want to verify your financials and due diligence. They may not go into a deep dive in year two and three, but they're certainly going to in year one. So bank statements are easy, right? You just save them from your bank statement. But the trick on all of these is if you go to your bank and you download your bank statements, it's going to say December 2020, January 2020, March 2020. And so when they're all in one file for the year 2020 bank statements, they're not going to be sequential. So rename them 1.2020, 2.2020, 3.2020, so that when your buyer jumps into Google Drive, into your document folders, they're going to see a list of them. One's going to say bank statements. They click on that one. There's going to be three bank statement folders there. One's going to say bank statements 2020, bank statements 2019, bank statements 2018. When they click on one of those, it's going to say 1.2020, 2.2020. It's going to be so organized that it's going to impress them and instill confidence in them. And they're going to like you even more, and they're going to buy your business with no adjustments and no hassle and no pain. But you got to organize that as soon as you can. I think I'm popping up on the other screen over here, on the Quiet Light website. I believe we've got a document that sort of reviews what files you should have and how to organize them. And I'm seeing if our search, well, there's one by Chuck. Just yeah, go to the Quiet Light Brokerage website and pop in due diligence in the search bar. There's 24 due diligence tools. There's a whole bunch of things in there. There's like 7 or 8 articles, and some of them at one point there's a due diligence prep list. We share a specific PDF with folks when we start talking to them seriously about selling their business on how to get organized. I think you don't want to wait until you're under letter of intent to start getting organized. But you know what I tell folks is, once your business is listed for sale, okay, here's the docs we're going to need in a short period of time. Now that the frenzy of getting it prepared to sell is over, there's going to be a lull. Go ahead and get organized with that. The only challenge is if you changed banks within the last 12 to 24 months, you're going to have it may take you a week to get those, but it's not too bad, I don't think, Norm.
Yeah.
A couple of days of focus and you're done, and you could be well organized and prepared, so it's not so chaotic in due diligence.
One of the things that we even add, we go one step further. My VA hates me for this, but she has to add every receipt to, so they'll go in, if it's Bank of Montreal, it'll be all the statements, but then she has to match every receipt from my inbox to the statement. So it's one step more, but if somebody's looking, it's all there.
Yeah. 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 Hey, I love this question Norman Ho presented. It's such a common question, so I just want to jump into it. Sorry, Kelsey, I don't mean to take your job over here. I'm going to be the next co-host of Lunch with Norm. Norman Ho asked, does the amount an owner takes in income adversely affect the multiple or valuation? And it's a really, really good question. So let me tell you the answer of that by example. So let's just say that you're running a great business, Norman, and you're taking $200,000 in salary. Okay, you're able to pay yourself $200,000. And when you run a profit and loss statement, the net income is zero. Does that mean your business is worth nothing? No, because that's an owner benefit to you as the owner of the business. Remember, add backs are owner benefits or one-time expenses that don't carry forward, like a design patent, utility patent expenses, things of that nature. But your personal salary as an owner, as long as you're working 40 hours a week or less, is a 100% add back. So you could be paying yourself $10 or $10,000 or $100,000 a month. It doesn't matter. It's a 100% add back. The only exception is when, if you've got a husband and wife team and combined, you're working 60 hours a week and you're both taking equal salary, we have to adjust that a little bit because buyers are not looking to buy a business and work 60 hours a week. So we do a partial add back on that second owner.
Makes sense? You're capping it at 40.
Yeah, capping it at 40. Yeah.
All right, Kels, any other questions before Joe grabs it?
Yeah, he'll jump on it. We have quite a few still, but I know you have to get going by one. So are there any questions that you think that are priority? Or
Now he's putting it all on me as if I read more.
Right. You want my job now. So
I don't know. You're Norm's son. I have the feeling he doesn't pay very well. So I think I'll stick to doing what I'm doing now.
All right. Let's see. We got Nathan. Does he currently have any Amazon FBA businesses on sale in the 20,000 range?
No, we don't, Nathan. Again, those smaller listings are generally pocket deals where we make intros. Actually, yes. There's one where it's not for sale, but I'd be happy to make an introduction. It's in the baby space for nursing mothers, and discretionary earnings in the trailing 12 months is about $12,000. So we're really looking at about $36,000. So no, it's not in the $20,000 range, but if $36,000 is doable for you, send me an email, joe@quietlightbrokerage.com. I'll send an email intro to the owner of the business and I'll get out of the way. It's too small for us to take on and actually list unless it's a simple one. So you can just buy me and Norm and Kelsey a beer someday for that introduction if you buy the business.
Oh, hey, John, is my mic level okay now? I did move it up a bit. So hopefully John had mentioned that the level was really low.
Oh, it sounds okay for us. But
okay, perfect.
All right, we'll do maybe one more. Okay, let's see. Do one from Victor. What level of accounting statement rigor is appropriate for this kind of M&A transaction, reviewed versus audited?
Yeah, don't worry about the audited. We're going to do a light quality of earnings process in terms of reviewing your P&Ls and putting a value on it. If you're going to be in the 10 million plus range, the buyer may choose to do their own quality of earnings. So that's obviously going to extend the length of time in due diligence, but you don't need to do that work in advance. You do have to have a good quality bookkeeper running your books on an accrual basis so that when you export a profit loss statement, we can get to the true seller's discretionary earnings. But beyond that, we're going to do a light quality of earnings on it. You don't need to go hire a company doing $20,000 or $30,000 worth of quality of earnings. I'm going to throw in two more quick answers. Everybody, I've got a call to start in 6 minutes, so I'm going to quickly answer a couple of things here, Norm. Norman Ho, and I'm taking over Kelsey's job again. Sorry, I'm going to talk quick. Norman Ho, the buyers are all over the place. They could be mom and pop people. They could be multiple repeat buyers of Amazon businesses. They could be holding companies that bought 40 of them before. If you want to get the most value for your business, you want the average person off the street that just wants to be an entrepreneur. They're going to pay the most value for your business, for sure. It can be, they can need more, a little bit more transition and training time, but if they're going to pay an extra $100,000 for an extra 20 hours worth of work, I think you should take it. After the exit, how non-compete clause. So my process is fairly simple. It's the non-compete should equal the multiple, simple as that. So if you're selling glass fishing poles on Amazon and I buy your business for $1 million and I pay you a 3x multiple, you've got $333,000 in discretionary earnings. I pay you $1 million. I want you to sign a non-compete where you're no longer going to sell glass fishing poles for 3 years. You can sell anything else you want on Amazon or anywhere else in the world on any platform. I don't care, as long as it's not glass fishing poles. But you have every right to sell on Amazon and anything on any of the platforms, as long as it's not competing with the existing product.
Interesting. So you base it, you base the non-compete on multiple.
It's logical, right? It's all, otherwise there's no reason behind it. People just pick it, pick a number of years. The reality is that once you're done with a business and you want to move on, you're going to move on to another adventure in a different space. Mm-hmm. The buyer just doesn't want to pay you $1 million to just have you turn around and compete with them in 10 days.
Right.
So you do the multiple, and it's kind of math and logic and just kind of works for everybody.
Okay. So you are down to 5 minutes, 4 minutes. So let's call it a day, unless there's any other one last tip that you want to give.
Yeah, my last tip would simply be run your business in a way in which you're thinking not just of yourself, but the other buyer, the eventual buyer of your business. If you want to get maximum value for your business, and if you want to have the best transaction possible. The reality is, for a growing Amazon business where you're taking most of the profits and cash flow and putting it back into inventory, the reality is that you're going to make more money the day that you sell your business than, you know, running it. You're at least 50% of the money. I've seen people make 90% of the money or all of the money for the most part on the day that they sell it. So you've got to have good, clean books. You've got to think about the next buyer of your business. You got to do some shit you don't like, which is accounting and getting good details in there and maturing in that sense. But more than anything else, don't grow the business to your own level of incompetence, where you start doing things that you don't like to do, but you got to do them because you own the business and you just think you should be growing it even further. Because you're just kind of screwed up at that point. Because trust me, I say that from experience. You don't enjoy it and you stop doing it well. And when you stop doing it well, the customer knows it and the revenues are reflected in it and the value goes down when your trends dip pretty quickly. Right.
Okay, sir. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I've got a ton of questions still here, so we got to get you back on another podcast.
I'd love to be on anytime. Hey,
how do we contact you?
I think the best thing is just go to quietlightbrokerage.com. And if somebody wants to get a valuation, I really recommend it 12 to 24 months in advance. Just fill out the valuation form. Anybody on our team will help you out. We don't charge anything for it. We don't charge anything until the business eventually sells. So we're here to help first and foremost, but quietlightbrokerage.com, I think that's where all the tools and resources are and access to us and the listings and things of that nature.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the podcast today, Joe. I know you got to take off, so we'll see you later. Thank you.
Thank you, Norm. Thanks, Kelsey.
All right, everybody. So if you do have any questions, just throw them in the comments and we will be answering them later on after the podcast ends. But let's see. What do we have, Kelsey? Come on back.
All right. Yeah. So please follow us on social media. We have Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. You can find it all. If you are looking for the full replay of this, you can just head on over to our YouTube channel. We've got some fun new templates, if you haven't noticed yet.
Let us know what you think of the new templates.
Yeah. Is it confusing? Do you like it? What do you think? I'd love to hear your feedback. I really like it personally.
I wonder why.
But yeah, also our Facebook group, as you can see coming across in this ticker box here, you can search Lunch with Norm, Amazon FBA and E-commerce Collective. You've got everything. You can find, we're going to be talking about questions, advice, anything Amazon and e-commerce related we'll be diving into. So yeah, we'll have like Stupid Question Tuesday. We'll be talking about post threads from these episodes. Please join and join the community.
Yeah, and a lot of the experts that are on the podcast are also going to be involved with the community. So that'll be great. So hopefully we could talk Joe into joining it. But all right, so we've got a newsletter. And it's out there today, by the way. The new newsletter is always out Mondays. It doesn't suck. If you want to get some really great information about the industry, sign up. You're not going to be targeted by hundreds of different people. All we're doing is we're just giving you content. So if you'd like to check it out and let us know what you think of the newsletter, it's available. So if you'll sign up today, you'll see the newest one that was just released about an hour ago. And let's see, next Wednesday or this Wednesday, we're going to be joined. This is cool. Bill King. I don't know if you've heard of him. I stumbled on a piece of software, an app the other day that I don't know if many people know that I have a content marketing company. We don't promote it here, but I was looking at this app because it made our job so much simpler. So Bill King's the head of marketing for a company called Phrase.io. Check it out. I got nothing to do with affiliate. Check it out what it can do. And if you want, if you get some questions before Wednesday, you know, just throw them in. But he is going to be talking about strategies on how to win on Google and content marketing using Phrase.io. It is really cool. Don't miss out. And I think that's probably it. Until next Wednesday, just remember to tune in every Monday, Wednesday, Friday at noon Eastern Standard Time. And we'll see you next time.
It looks like Norm has a question about the newsletter. It should be, if you go to this link that I'm not sure if you're in the personal profile, Lunch with Norm, or the beard guy one, but if you go to this link, you should be able to subscribe with it.
Right.
So I'll put this in the personal profile as well. But yeah.
And I think it's on Lunch with Norm too. So, but either or.
Yep.
Okay. Right, so get ready to hit that button for the song.
All right.
All right, everybody. Yeah. We'll see you next week. I hope you enjoyed the show. See you later. Lunch with Norm.